Hi, it's Kim. And as we may have mentioned, we have been in Kenya recently, where we met some of our lovely listeners and other podcasters. And of course, while we were there, we combed Nairobi and beyond to find some stories. Stories about how the city is changing and why so many people are contemplating a move to somewhere greener. How do you navigate fatherhood when your challenges go beyond the usual expectations? And is Kenya's natural beauty reserved for rich international visitors? These are stories that we found in Kenya, but speak to challenges that people are experiencing all over the continent. But first, I'm exploring something that's been a growing conversation, at least in Kenya's podcasting community in recent years. Sexual empowerment, ownership and control of your own sexuality. I'm speaking to two Kenyan women. In some ways, their lives couldn't be much more different. And yet, they've each been on a journey to understand, embrace and control their own sexual identities, overcoming traumas and taboos along the way.
Sex was supposed to be something explosive and enjoyable. The girls described their boyfriends in a way that I wondered. But that's not what I experienced. At that time, I realized something is not right here.
And just a heads up, we are going to be having frank discussions about sex and also FGM in this episode. I'm Kim Chakaneta, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
So the first lady I'm meeting is actually a fellow podcaster. Her name is Kaz Lucas. She's the host of the Spread podcast, which, especially if you're Kenyan, I'm sure you've heard of Kaz. And she lives in Nairobi. So right now we're in the car, in a bit of traffic, but we're winding down the lush, very green roads of Nairobi on our way to see her. Hi, Kaz. Hi, how are you?
I'm sorry that the security guards gave you issues.
No, it's all right. They were very diligent. You're safe.
I'm Kaz. I'm in entertainment. I wear many hats, and then every time people ask, I'm like, oh gosh, I actually...
That many hats are.
Yeah. Today, I'm a sex educator and a podcaster. Yes.
If you're a podcast fan and Kaz's voice sounds familiar, it's because she's host of one of Kenya's most popular podcasts, The Spread.
Hello and welcome to The Spread Podcast. I'm your host, Kaz.
More on that later. And I should just explain that as we chatted in Kaz's flat, there were some kids outside who were having a great time and making quite a lot of noise. So if you hear some screaming, that's what that is.
So, Kaz, I know lots of people, especially in Kenya, know you as the voice of The Spread.
Yes.
And I don't actually want to talk about that just yet. Okay. I want to know a little bit about you first. So tell me, where did you grow up?
Born and raised in Kenya. I've actually spent my whole entire life here. It was a lot quieter.
Kaz says she moved around a lot as a teenager after her parents split up, jumping back and forth between their houses as they moved around in the Nairobi suburbs. But she says life was privileged.
I grew up in the good side of Nairobi, and I went to good schools. I had a good education. I never went to uni. I did my A-levels, and then that was it. I started working.
It seems like Kaz was always destined to be someone in the spotlight.
I've always had the drive to be in entertainment, so I started performing when I was 14 years old.
But where does that come from? Was it just something inherent?
I feel like it was, but then my mother was a singer.
Oh.
She really loved to sing, and my dad was just like a lover of music. Like, we just were immersed in music, my brother and I, our whole entire lives. Like, it was just like our house was filled with music. My mother was singing. My brother and I are both musicians.
Because you've lived many lives.
I have. I really have, and continue to.
Oh, okay. Well, let's come to the present day life again. Let's talk about, let's go a little bit back.
Okay.
When did you first learn about sex?
Ooh, this is a story I tell often. As early as I can remember, maybe 6 or 7 years old.
What were you learning about?
Just discovering my body.
Okay.
Yeah. And also I had access to media. So my parents were actually quite liberal and quite open with the way that they that they loved each other. My parents were very, very like passionate with their relationship. They were a very passionate and fiery couple. And that's how I sort of started learning about different aspects of sexuality and discovering myself.
Would you also have conversations around it?
My family is unlike any other family that I've ever encountered. Like, I didn't grow up in the religious household where people prayed all the time. Like, we did not have that. We are just like a very, very, very liberal bunch. We speak about everything. We're just like really open with conversation.
But the openness of her environment to discussions about sexuality, unfortunately, wasn't the only thing that shaped Kaz's early experiences.
So if you were to place yourself in terms of like where you were and how you felt about sex and sexuality at that point of your life, what would you say?
I have had experiences of sexual assault as a child and as a teenager, and unfortunately recurring throughout my life.
Kaz says those experiences had a very particular impact on her sexual identity.
I became really hypersexual because of it.
How would that manifest itself? For people who might not understand the term.
Okay, so I think I used like sex as a weapon as a young person. And I started having sex at a really early age.
At the time, Kaz says she felt like she was the one in control, wielding her sexuality as a powerful tool. But looking back now, she sees things differently.
I had many different sexual interactions with people. Some of them were not, I want to use the word consent, they were not consensual. And the reason I'm saying this is because over the years I've began to understand the true meaning of consent and what consent isn't. And I know that a lot of women have had similar situations, and this is the reason why I'm actually okay having conversations like this, is because we sometimes often find ourselves in situations where we're with people and the only way out is to say yes to having sex. There was many of those incidents that happened, and I'm just, you know, thinking that they were okay at the time, and then just like over time through the healing process and going through therapy, realizing that actually, yeah, and trying to figure out, like, why am I doing this? Like, what is it for? Is it, like, to be, like, a cool kid? You know, I'm a kid who's having sex.
Yeah.
And why? You know, just, like, so many things are also just, like, trauma responses and realizing that.
Yeah.
And then just things began to change for me. And that's actually the reason why the spread is so important and why I started doing the podcast and having like really open, candid conversations about my sexuality, because I know many people can relate to the situations that I've had or things that I'm going through. And as I learn, other people learn with me.
Kaz launched The Spread back in 2016 with the hope of shifting the way we talk about sex and sexuality, and crucially, to help address a basic need in Kenya: sex education.
My co-host and myself are both women, and we both had similar experiences growing up, and we both were at a point where we wanted other people to learn from our mistakes. This is what you shouldn't do. The sex education that we are receiving is all very negative based and just, you know, focused on its sex negativity, like disease and unwanted pregnancies and death and just all of these negative aspects. So people are coming out of school with so much fear attached to their sexuality, attached to their bodies.
So in the absence of spaces for people to have these conversations, to be able to talk frankly about whatever their sexual concerns and their sexuality, what do you think that absence leads to?
And it's not even what can happen, it's what's been happening.
Okay.
Women who are afraid to talk about things that are happening with their vaginas. And then because you're scared to have a conversation with a friend and you're scared to go to the doctor because you don't want to be told what it really is. Or people in relationships, like, you know, people are having unprotected sex with their partners and having fears that their partners are out being with other people, but I don't want to ask them to get tested because I'm scared. So the more we talk about it, the more we create comfortability around the topics. Let's not be so afraid of these things. Let's stop stigmatizing conversations. Spread.
Hello and welcome to The Spread, a safe and loving space where we get to express our sexuality with absolutely no judgment.
We talk to two members of our audience as they share how their coming out stories shaped their lives.
In this episode, we talk to sex workers and get their take on experiences during this quarantine.
Religion in the bedroom.
Obviously, The Spread is now very well established. But let's... thinking back to when you first launched back in 2016, did it feel kind of rebellious or revolutionary to be doing something?
It was very... I vividly remember I was shaking in my boots.
You were?
Yes, shaking in my boots when we started The Spread. I was so worried about what people would say. And also because I have a history of being bullied by the press, I was so worried about what the press were going to say about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's exactly what happened.
In fact, when The Spread first launched, there was an attempt to shut it down. The production company Kaz was working with was threatened, and eventually they pulled out of the project.
I think people are afraid.
Yeah.
People are afraid of the truths that I speak, mm-hmm. because they've grown up living their lives in the complete opposite way, and everything that I'm doing is the antithesis of everything that they know and everything mm-hmm. that they've grown up with. And here I am saying, actually, it's okay to masturbate. Mm-hmm. And... you know, oh my gosh, like the Bible says. Too bad for you, you're missing out.
Yeah. Because obviously Kenya is a very religious country.
I'm rolling my eyes, BT Dubs.
Over 80% of Kenyans identify as Christian and over 10% as Muslim. With such a deeply religious country, the potential outrage over something which appears to be anti-religious is enormous. It's no joke launching anything, let alone something so very personal, amid such intense opposition.
I thought it was going to be the end of... I was like, oh, here we go again, I'm tired. And I couldn't get out of bed for a day. I was just like, I'm tired of fighting.
But why plow on? I mean, what is in you that makes you... Because I guess, you know, I'm just like, oh, okay, never mind.
Yeah.
And move on. But you kind of just carried on. You pursued the project.
Yeah.
What made you do that?
The Spread has always been and will always be bigger than just me. So even though you're saying you are The Spread, you're the spirit of The Spread.
Yeah.
I am, yes. But like The Spread itself is actually a much bigger entity than myself. And the work that I'm doing is not for me. The work that I'm doing is saving people's lives. The work that I'm doing is helping people in marginalized communities, giving information to people who wouldn't have otherwise received this kind of information. So if I stop, it's selfish. So I need to keep going. And that's the way it's going to be.
I fully understand that, but that's a lot of weight to put on yourself though, Kaz.
You know what? I mean, it's just one life, right? Yeah, it's okay. It's worth it.
I grew up in a family where we were four girls. I didn't have a brother, and I think that was a big problem.
This is Lucy. That's not her real name, and that's not her voice either. Lucy's story includes some really sensitive information. So for both her and her family's sake, we're protecting her identity. And my colleague Esther is speaking her words. Lucy's childhood couldn't be much more different from Kaz's. Where Kaz was navigating her super liberal family life, Lucy's home was very conservative, ultimately shaped by patriarchal expectations and values.
If a woman did not have boys, we were not considered to be children. When my mom was married to my stepfather, she was paid for dowry. So that meant whether the man was good or bad, because they were abusive, she had to stick there. It was very abusive. And now when I look back at my childhood, I think my mom had accepted that so long as she'd been paid for dowry, she had to do everything her husband demanded.
Within this harsh family setup, Lucy was especially vulnerable. She was the child of her mother's former partner, a fact that was always visible due to the different skin tone she had inherited from her biological dad.
I was black and my sisters are very light-skinned. So from day one, that man made it clear that you're not my daughter. You're black, you're ugly. My siblings gave me a name which in our culture means the hated one. I grew up knowing I was ugly and I was not needed.
Lucy, did you really believe that, you were ugly?
I think so. Because even when I got married, my husband called me that for so many years.
Lucy says her way of coping was to focus on schoolwork, in the hope that her intelligence and hard work would earn her a way out of her situation, to a different kind of life. When did you first learn about sex?
When we were growing up, like at school, you know the way boys and girls get in the bushes and they come back explaining what they've done? But I couldn't do that because I was black and ugly, remember? But they would talk about it. So from a young age, I knew they would get in the bushes, but I did not do that. So from that age, I was able to pick up sex.
And what were you picking up? What did you understand?
Number one, it was supposed to be a secret, and it was only for beautiful girls.
Listening to Lucy's recollections, it's striking how high her exposure to sex was at a young age. But at the same time, there was little or no discussion or explanation.
Because most people lived in houses where it was like one round grass thatch house, so the kids were being exposed to sex because they shared one house with their parents. But it was not supposed to come out. In that community, we don't discuss sex. It's a taboo. And especially for children, you're not even told a name for the genitals. It's censored. You just don't talk about it.
Just one aspect of sexuality was discussed openly.
The other thing I learned about sex at that age was that for you to be a complete woman, you had to undergo FGM. It wasn't even a secret. August holidays, they would announce in schools, in the churches, that there's going to be circumcision. And for girls who are not circumcised, there was a label. Like in Kamba, it's called Nkode or Ikode, the bad one. Trust me, that was not the best label to have.
So how old were you when it happened?
I was in class 3. 7 years, because I started school when I was underage. I remember that day. It was a Friday and it was a market day. Circumcisions used to be done on market days where everyone knows where the circumcisers have gone. So we would know who are the outcasts, because our brothers are not supposed to marry the uncircumcised girls. So it was a Friday afternoon and my mom had gone to the market as usual. The market days were a day where we would eat all the fruits. But that Friday was different. When my mom came home from the market that day, she came with 4 fat women. To me, they looked fat because we were kind of small.
Did you know what was going to happen?
We'd been told on Friday, you're going to be circumcised. It was everyone except one family who were in the Protestant church. That family is the only one in the area whose kids did not go through FGM.
Did you understand what was going to happen to you physically, Lucy? Did anyone explain?
No, but there were these bigger girls who had already gone through it. The only thing they would describe was the pain.
Lucy's recollection of the procedure is honestly too harrowing for us to include here. But I will say that Lucy had made a decision for herself that she didn't want the circumcision.
I didn't have a choice because I was a child. But deep in me, I knew I don't want to go through this. Because I thought FGM was for the good children, and I'm not.
So when it came to her turn, Lucy fought back.
I kept kicking and kicking, kicking.
But the woman didn't stop. And the procedure went wrong. Lucy says she thinks she nearly bled to death. Her recovery took much longer than it was meant to, and it left her with permanent complications and pain. Lucy, following that very traumatic experience, at what age did you start to really understand what had been done to you?
Definitely, we were in a society where going through FGM was like a rite of passage. So as long as you've gone through that, you don't get that label of shame, right? So I didn't have that label, but I knew that something in me kept telling me that it was not right.
Were you able to talk to anyone about it?
At that age, no. Because you become a woman, so what's your problem? I think from that time, something in me changed. I developed a certain hatred for that community.
When asked Lucy about her first relationship, her answer isn't what you might expect or hope to hear. A first crush, young, immature, romantic flutterings. Lucy's answer is practical, and it comes back to her determination to get a university education, which she hoped would be her gateway to a different kind of life. Lucy said she went looking for a man who would support her.
So I talked to one and I asked him, "Oh, you go to university?" And he was like, "Yeah." So that boy is the one who told me, "If you become my girlfriend, I'll take you to get a loan."
So that was the deal that Lucy agreed to.
I traded sex to be shown where to get a university loan. It was very painful. Very, very painful.
So Lucy went to university. It was a different world to the one she had grown up in. It also became another turning point in her understanding of sex and sexuality and her relationship with her own sexual identity.
I used to hear the other girls describing sex, that sex was supposed to be something explosive and enjoyable. The girls described their boyfriends in a way that I wondered. But that's not what I experienced. At that time, I realized something is not right here.
And after the trauma Lucy had endured in order to be considered acceptable in her home community, she now found that a very different attitude to FGM existed elsewhere.
I expected that at university we would have status because we are circumcised. At university, I learned it's no longer a privilege to be circumcised. In fact, you should hide the fact that you're circumcised. So here you are, a misfit. Now you have to go hide something.
When I ask Lucy about her relationships at this time in her life, there's one overriding emotion that dominated all her interactions.
Throughout my university life, I think I just repeated one thing. I don't like you. You're a man, and I hate you.
And Lucy's status as a circumcised woman kept haunting her, even later when she was married.
He abused me more. He called me ugly. He reminded me that he's leaving me to get a woman who has a clitoris and who is a complete woman. It was the reverse of what I was told in the village.
It was in 2014 that Lucy learned reconstructive surgery was possible. The procedure is said to restore sexual pleasure, as well as reducing the chronic pain which is often suffered by FGM survivors.
We had a support group because we were the first group of women who underwent reconstructive surgery. We went through a pre-counseling session. You could talk to the doctor one-on-one. And then after that, there was surgery day. And then after that, there was a lot of follow-up.
The support from that group of women, largely expressed via WhatsApp group chat, became an important part of Lucy's recovery.
I listened to the experiences of the other women and I realized I wasn't even the worst among them.
Conversations with so many women from a diversity of backgrounds, but all sharing the same trauma, allowed Lucy to reflect on her own experiences in a new way.
I realized men should support us. And if you marry a woman who has gone through FGM, you should understand it was done to me at age 7. Why would you bash me over it and run away? So through that support group, we've been able to support each other emotionally. I think they opened my eyes to exactly what is sexuality. Even the healing, it became a forum to share photos. I'm healing this way, or I've tried this. Some were not healing as quick as others. So it was a process where all of us went through it together.
It sounds to me, Lucy, that the surgery was completely transformative.
Totally.
How have your feelings about sex changed post-surgery?
So much has changed. I view sex positively now. It is a part of us as humans and it should not be suppressed. As a woman, my sexuality shall not be suppressed. Everything changed. I think my mind got liberated.
It's clear that the Lucy I've met is confident and independent enough to be happy and fulfilled as a single agent. She says that she's now open to finding love, but it will have to be a relationship unlike any she's experienced before.
That reconstructive surgery gave me confidence. I tell men today I'm not single because I like men to marry me. No, it's because I need a certain quality of relationship. I look for a holistic package. I want a man with brains. I'm not that girl that men used to toss around, or I would be crying, "Are you leaving me?" Mm-mm. Today, something in me has changed. And I know one day I will remarry. I don't believe in being single. But a relationship has to have dignity and respect. I'm done with being called a circumcised woman.
I want to go back to Kaz, who's trying to open up the space for conversation so that this kind of self-understanding and empowerment can be a normal part of life for Kenyan women.
One of the things that I didn't understand about myself was the hypersexualization, right, of myself. And the more that I spoke about the traumas that I had experienced in my life, the more that I began to understand just how much of my sexual experiences were not for me, they were for other people. Sometimes they were for the greater good, I quote, but not really. It's just like what I thought. It was for popularity. It was so that I could hang out with a certain, you know, it was just like trying to figure out who I was in my 20s, trying to figure out where I fit in. And then just the more I had conversations, realizing that actually, and it was such a great realization, like, I'm actually not hypersexual at all. Like, it's not who I am. And one of the things that happened to me when I started the spread and I started like my journey of sex education is that I had a lot less sex. I thought that once I started talking about sex and meeting all these sex positive people that I would just be having so much wonderful, great sex. Mm-hmm. And that is not what happened. Yeah, I just started to understand that the way that I interact with people is actually more important than like the physical aspect of things. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've always been that extroverted being because of being in the music industry and just because of being in entertainment, thinking that there was a certain kind of life that I needed to lead. But actually, yeah, that's not for me. I actually want to sit home and listen to a good audiobook or something.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Comb. Next week, fatherhood and autism.
When I told my mom, her first reaction was, there's nothing wrong with him, he's just shy. So you're like, you know, we've given him some time, he's not shy. It's a neurological condition. It's like, no, he's just shy, just give him some time, he doesn't need any therapy. My mother-in-law had said, bring him to us, give us 2 weeks with him and we'll send him back to you talking. Those are the initial reactions we got from telling people, so we said, maybe let's not tell a lot of people, because a lot of people don't know how to respond.
This episode was produced by Mary Goodhart, Esther Akello-Ogola, and me, Kim Chakaneta. Rob Wilson did the sound design. Our studio manager was Caroline Driscoll, and Piers Lynch is our editor.